I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pine.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
And my understanding, Stephen, is that over the years, for reasons I'm not entirely sure, that the policy of the Forest Service has been to prevent the natural forest fires that make trees and forests healthier, and that this has led to a buildup of underbrush fuel that makes it all but inevitable that forest fires and forests and trees will be killed by much more intense and catastrophic fires like the one that we're witnessing now in Yosemite.
Well, that's about a third right, but that's a common perception. First of all, many ecosystems are adapted to fire, but they're adapted to a particular pattern of fire. So the critical thing is not whether you have fire or not, exclude fire or introduce fire. It's the way it's done, just as, you know, things are adapted to patterns of rainfall, not just to rain. That's part of it, and we adopted a policy of fire exclusion directly and indirectly for a long time. We tried that, and that allowed all the stuff simply keep growing and building up. But again, it depends what that growth means. Just adding biomass doesn't add fuel. What the fire requires is small stuff, the grasses, the twigs, the branches, the shrubs, the stuff that can go very quickly. So even after a very large fire goes through a mature forest, most of the biomass is still standing. You see all these dead snags. What burned off were the needles and so forth. So it's not just that because you kept fire out, you automatically get more fuel. In many cases, that's true, but not everywhere. And the other part of that equation is that for 50 years, primarily following the trauma of the 1910 fires, the Forest Service in particular did everything it could to remove fire from the landscape, to suppress it, to keep it as contained as possible in their managed forests. And the last 50 years, the federal agencies have been trying to find ways to put fire back in some benign way. They're still committed, of course, to fighting the fires we don't want, but they recognize we have to encourage or light the fires that we do. And it's how to actually make that happen has been the problem. But it's not a new idea. For over 40 years, the National Park Service has had official policy to restore fire. The Forest Service for about 35 years. This is not a new concept. The difficulty has been actually implementing it on the ground.
Well, my understanding, Stephen Pine, as it relates to the giant sequoias that apparently there's a couple of groves that are threatened. And these, of course, are amongst the Earth's largest and oldest living things, and that they can resist fire. And then fire actually helps them to break open the cones and spread the seeds. But if you have the kind of fire that's happening now in Yosemite, which they call a crown fire, that it goes across the tops of the canopies and burns the leaves and canopies, that's catastrophic. So a fire that comes along the ground that burns the brush and stuff, and that's the good fire, and the one that goes across the tops generated by massive winds is the bad fire. Am I on the right track here?
You're on the right track, but again, you have to vary it by, you know, the different species and habitats. Sequoias, ponderosa pine, interior Doug fir, many kinds of species, longleaf pines in the south, do very well with routine surface fire. They need it, even hot surface fire. They thrive in it. Uh, it it encourages them, and then some of them, as with the sequoias, it's necessary to sort of liberate the seeds and then create an ash bed that the seeds thrive in. All this is perfect. The problem is when you change the kinds of fires. And what you're describing is exactly the potential threat to these sorts of groves. But it's also true for all the kinds of forests we have that used to have surface fire and don't. But there are also other kinds of forests for which the natural fire is a crown fire, that they simply, every 80, 200, maybe 400 years, they have these immolating fires that go through the crowns and seem to destroy everything, but in fact is part of the regenerative process. So it's not just that everything, all crown fires are bad, some are good. You just don't want crown fires next to sequoias and suburbs.
Which is what you have now, right, in Yosemite?
Well, that appears to be, we certainly have, it seems to have part of it. And I don't have any special details on the Yosemite fire, but it does seem to be potentially threatening the groves. It's certainly threatening communities. And we can only hope that those communities and the agencies responsible for managing the groves, you know, have cleared out some space, have years ago begun the process of preparing to accept fires and to be resilient against them. And they can certainly tolerate fire. They just can't take the kind of fire that may be coming their way. We'll just have to see.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He's the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. So are we at a situation now, though, because of these fires, and they seem to be happening more frequently, and I understand that back in, 2000, that big fire outside of Los Alamos in New Mexico, that was even started, I believe, by an attempt to burn the underbrush that ran,
that's right,
got out of control and caused enormous fire. and on the scale of what we're seeing now, perhaps even worse. But I talked to somebody today from New Mexico in charge of the Valle Caldera Reserve, and she was already up in Montana fighting a fire. So
yep. Well,
they're happening all over, right?
Well, it's mostly in the Northwest and along California right now, and you know, it up until now it had not been an exceptional fire season. The fires were going where they usually go, at the times they usually happen. The interest in the fire season was the homes destroyed in the Black Forest fire in Colorado a year after Waldo Canyon had burned. And then, of course, the Yarnell Hill fire tragedy that swept over a crew. But before that, the number of fires in the acres burned was actually below average. Now it's moved where it does this time of year into the Northwest, the Northern Rockies, northern parts of California. That's the time. It's just that everything seems to be aligned perfectly in this area, and everything's exaggerated. So there's nothing unusual. It's just that it's all coming together with special force and intensity.
But in terms of the Forest Service's funding, my understanding is it's all having to go to firefighting as opposed to fire protection.
The funding thing, not unexpectedly, is a mess. And it's been getting worse for the last 20 years because it's costing more to fight fires, partly because you're having to protect a lot of structures and so forth, which are not part of, say, the National Forest or Park Service or BLM mission. But we're having to they're being responsible for protecting places along their perimeter or within their holdings. That's costing more. The technology is costing more. And Congress used to supply a supplemental funds at the end of the year to make up the difference. So you could not predict in advance how much fire season would cost. So you would spend what you needed, Congress would make up the difference, and things would go along. And there was a pile of money from the timber sales that allowed for a constant flow of money, so you didn't have a crunch. The timber sales are gone. Congress doesn't want to pay in the same way. There have been efforts to reform it, to create a pot, but that, again, anticipates how much you're going to have, and you can't predict that. And so then they're very angry when you spend more, but what? They're going to spend less? They're not. They're going to say, hey, we don't have any money. Too bad. Congress won't allow that, not if it's in their district. So, you know, the whole political paralysis we're seeing in other areas, why should fire be exempt from that? And it isn't. It's caught up with all the other issues and stuff. So, but it's not simply a case of not having enough money. We could have twice as much money, and we're not going to stop these fires. What we need to do is to take, we created, in effect, an ecological insurgency by our suppression policy early on, and it took decades for that to become apparent. And now the only way you're going to get control over those fires, you're going to have to take control of the countryside. You've got to manage how you live on the land, how you handle your houses and communities, your zoning, your building codes. You've also got to decide what kinds of practices you'll allow so you can treat this land so that it can tolerate fire, it can thrive under fire, it can absorb fire, so we don't have to spend billions of dollars, we don't have to lose lives, we don't have to do the kind of stuff we are now. In effect, it's not unlike our national health care system. We've got lots of money and fabulous emergency medicine, but we can't do the basics. We seem unable to handle that. And this is the equivalent. It's on a huge scale. We can't fix all of it, but we can begin rolling back some of the issues. We can certainly harden the assets that we want protected. We know we can do that. We're not going to be able to fight fires on these scales. They're just too big. The perimeter's enormous, and you can't tear up the landscape trying to stop them, and you can't put crews at risk recklessly under these extreme conditions. So we've got to be able to give these fires some more room, but we have to be able to tolerate that.
And how much, Stephen Pine, is the encroachment of homes into these forests and into these wilderness areas a part of the problem? In other words, is that because if the priority of protecting property seems to be greater than the priority of protecting the forests themselves, right?
That's right. But the issue then becomes, do you put your effort on the property itself, or do you put your effort trying to stop the fire so that it doesn't hit the homes? And right now, we've defined it as a wildland problem. We need to attack the fire to protect the homes, and we find ourselves unable to do that. And in fact, the homes can survive with basic treatments, and preventative measures and so forth. And there is a move to say, really, the responsibility resides with the homeowners, with the communities, with protecting, making their houses defensible and resilient, if you will. So, but that is a huge black hole in the whole fire story, and it's absorbing more and more resources and effort. And in some ways, there's a certain dismissiveness about it, I think, in much of the country because, well, the story is these people are stupidly moving their homes to where the fires are. But we haven't talked about climate change, and in some ways we don't need climate change for these big fires because we've got a climate otherwise we'd still have a fire problem. But if climate change develops the way people are predicting, what we're going to see is that the fires are going to move to where the houses are. That is, they're going to start moving to the east, and particularly to the southeast. And we may be seeing some of that already playing out in Texas. We're seeing others elsewhere. But that would be a real game changer. And then suddenly it's not just a quirky Western problem with retirees building these little exurbs where they shouldn't. It's going to be that the fires are going to come after us.
But in terms of fighting the fires, which is what we're witnessing now in Yosemite, apparently crown fires are really hard to fight, and that's what you're dealing with now, where the fire goes across the tops of the trees, the crowns, and sometimes at great speed, driven by winds that are increase as the fire itself increases. You have a kind of feedback loop there that creates these kind of tornado-type conditions. And the firefighters are on the ground, so the fire's going over the top of them. It seems that the only means are these airplanes dropping all of this fire retardant.
Yes and no. We'd like to think that's true. The problem is that when you have the extreme winds and all the turbulence associated with the fire creating its own convective columns and that interacting with the winds, you mix all that up, and dropping stuff from the air, dropping atomizing liquids from the air, isn't going to be very effective. It's just going to get blown away, and it's not safe for the planes to fly. So when you have the extreme winds, exactly when conditions are worse, when you would like to most control the fire, you can't. Our aerial techniques are not effective. They're much more effective on small fires, preventing fires from getting large. You can do some stuff to strengthen fire lines in advance. But simply dropping this stuff on the fire under those conditions is not very effective.
And again, Stephen Pine, author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires, and he's the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. What about, though, the climate change in terms of changing the climate, particularly in the Southwest where it's getting hotter and drier? It's pretty hard to deny that we're having more and more dramatic and damaging weather events.
Well, I tend to agree, but it's really hard to identify particular fires or particular fire seasons with climate change. And that's especially true in the Southwest because we have a documented history of mega droughts. I mean, what we've seen now is not as bad as what we've had in the past. I mean, 1,000 years ago, 800 years ago, in the record. So we're prone to droughts. We're prone to these conditions. Climate change may very well be part of the mix, but gosh, we would still have a terrible fire problem even without it. So I think what we may be seeing on the climate change issue are all the secondary effects, not just temperature and magnified weather systems, but the effect on insects, beetle epidemics, diseases, other kinds of stresses on vegetation that make them more prone to burn or damage them. And this kind of thing, you're getting a kind of synergy, maybe. And so it's a little more subtle set of interactions. Because fire, these big fires are not the equivalent of melting icebergs. I mean, if you've got melting glaciers, it's just a mechanical process. You heat it, it melts. But if you heat, you apply the same weather system to a landscape, and it's got to be refracted through all this biological system. Mm-hmm. And that's very complicated. And it's going to react in many, many ways. A lot of variability built into that. And then you put people on top of it, we've got social systems that also interact. And so suddenly it's not a mechanical process that if we have climate change, we've got to have these big fires. No, these are the result of land use changes. They're the result of how we manage fire, or they're the legacy consequences of stuff we've done and not done, and climatic effects, some of which may be new in the form of global warming, and some of which may be similar to what we've had in the past.
Well, but the idea, when you talk about hundreds of thousands of years of data on climate, I understand that those trees that are being threatened now, those groves of sequoias, how old are those trees? They're all, some of the oldest living things on the planet, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they're among that. They're probably 2,000-3,000 or more years. I'm not an expert. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of evidence. I mean, in some ways, it's remarkable that they even exist. I've always marveled. They're sort of a Pleistocene relic. It's like finding a giant ground sloth or something.
Right.
But how did they survive? And the earliest accounts we have is that they were burned over basically every year. But there was not very much on the ground to burn. They were just grassy. They were giant cathedral groves, these huge columns. And because they were burned over, primarily by people, they existed in a landscape that prevented the kind of crown fire, these really dense forest-sustained crown fires, from sweeping through them. So, in a sense, human fire practices may have been part of what spared them from succumbing, like all the other megafauna and megaflora. Pleistocene. I don't know that, but it seems to me at least plausible.
Well, we can only hope that it survives.
They're irreplaceable, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
They really are. And it would be tragic, and it would be hard to justify why didn't we take steps to protect them. And I don't know what they've done or not done. I can't speak to that. But they've certainly been aware
right.
that this is a threat. And I assume they have over the years been doing things to help protect those groves, let them survive this kind of fire.
Sure. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Pine.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He's a Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the number of abortion clinics that have closed due to state legislation.